I'm going to be speaking this morning from one of the Psalms, and I'm going to be speaking for around about sort of 25 minutes or so. And for those of you in the Facebook group, that will then be hopping into a Zoom call to share communion together. I should say at the outset, if you would like to get more involved with Grace Church, do drop us an email at info@gracetruro.org, or put a note on the page, or get in touch with whatever platform you're seeing this on. I would love to find out how we can serve you and draw you into this church community. Have you ever found yourself saying these words, "Lord God, I need answers. I'm really sinking right now and I don't know what to do. If you can't answer me, I'm no better off than someone who ignores you. I'm just going to fail like everyone else who's going through this. I've decided to trust you, to follow you. So please give me some sign of your love for me. I need you to fix this situation, and I need you to show me how to do it your way. Please help. Please step in and change things." If you feel like that, or if you felt like that over the last week, then you are in good company. You're in the company of David, the greatest ever king of Israel. When Jesus turned up on earth, those around him said that he was inheriting David's throne. It was one of the best things that they could say about him. And in this great, with this great king, at more than one point in his life, David felt exactly the same way that you did. So what did David do about that? Let's read Psalm 143 and find out. And before we do that, I'm just going to pray. Dad, we're so grateful that we're not the first ones to go through and tread through difficult times. And we thank you that you're not asking us to find the answers. Would you please speak to us? Would you change us today, Lord? We need your help. Amen. So, I'd love to read Psalm 143 together. I know this might feel a bit strange, but please would you read it out loud along with me. I'm going to put the words up as well so that you can. And let's read this together. These psalms are written to be sung together. Okay, here we go. A psalm of David. Lord, hear my prayer. Listen to my cry for mercy. In your faithfulness and righteousness, come to my relief. Do not bring your servant into judgment, for no one living is righteous before you. The enemy pursues me. He crushes me to the ground. He makes me dwell in the darkness like those long dead. So my spirit grows faint within me. My heart within me is dismayed. I remember the days of long ago. I meditate on all your works and consider what your hands have done. I spread out my hands to you. I thirst for you like a parched land. Answer me quickly, Lord. My spirit fails. Do not hide your face from me, or I will be like those who go down to the pit. Let the morning bring me word of your unfailing love, for I have put my trust in you. Show me the way I should go, for to you I entrust my life. Rescue me from my enemies, Lord, for I hide myself in you. Teach me to do your will, for you are my God. May your good spirit lead me on level ground. For your name's sake, Lord, preserve my life. In your righteousness, bring me out of trouble. In your unfailing love, silence my enemies. Destroy all my foes, for I am your servant. So, before we're going to dive into applying this psalm to us, we're going to spend a little bit of time in David's world. David, the guy who wrote this psalm in the first place. So after David famously defeated Goliath, you may have heard the story of David and Goliath. He was shortly afterwards a warrior in the army, and then a commander in that army. In fact, the greatest commander in that army under King Saul. He was fabulously successful, so much so, in fact, that unfortunately a bit too successful, and King Saul felt that he was a bit of a threat and David had to run for his life. So he, first of all, he ran off back to the mountains, back to the area where he was born. He knew that area, he sheltered in that area for a little while, and then he went somewhere else to hide for a bit of time. King Saul kept hunting him down, but he was also engaged in battles with another nation, the Philistines. Now, we don't have a precise timeline, but it seems that David was being hunted by his nation for around 5 or 10 years. Can you imagine being hunted by the British Army on and off for that long? It would be pretty grueling, pretty frightening. I don't imagine that David loved it. During that time, even though he was being hunted by him, David had a couple of opportunities to kill King Saul, and he didn't take them because he loved God so much, because he respected that God had appointed Saul as king. But eventually Saul was killed in battle with Philistines and David did take the throne. Now we've got a bit of context. I think we can understand when David says, "For your name's sake, Lord, preserve my life," he really means it. He really means it. So in this rough situation then, let's read David's prayer again, shall we? And let's look with particular eye for who is doing what through this psalm. So here's this, the first part. It says, "Lord, hear my prayer. Listen to my cry for mercy. In your faithfulness and righteousness, come to my relief. Do not bring your servant into judgment, for no one living is righteous before you." David's praying, he's crying for mercy, and God is listening. And David's just asking him not to judge here. The next section, the enemy pursues me, he crushes me to the ground, he makes me dwell in the darkness like those long dead. My spirit grows faint within me, my heart within me is dismayed. Now the enemy's chasing, David's feeling empty, he's feeling hopeless. And David, having prayed in the first section, this is the central bit of David's activity. This next bit we're going to come to. "I remember the days of long ago. I meditate on all your works and consider what your hands have done. I spread out my hands to you. I thirst for you like a parched land." David remembers, he meditates and considers all that God's done in history. Let's just spend some time here, because this is the last major piece of action that David gets in the whole psalm. There's a couple of other lines a bit later on about him trusting God with his life, but this is the key bit of David's activity. All the rest, all the other proactivity comes from God. And David remembers the days of long ago. This suggests that he's remembering not what God's done over the last kind of few days. He's looking back to all that God did in history. He created the world, and then he chose this nation, Israel, David's nation, to pick it out, to make it a light on a lampstand for the world. He chose Abraham. He did everything necessary. He gave this man who had no children, he made him the father of a nation. He saved them from starvation by taking them to Egypt with that story of Joseph. If you've seen Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat, you may remember that. He rescued them from slavery when the Egyptians then enslaved them, took them out of Egypt and took them to a land of their own. He bore with them during that journey that took them 40 years because they couldn't bring themselves to trust the promises of God, eventually led them into a new country under Joshua, and so on. And David remembers all of this and meditates on it. He also considers it. David immerses himself in the goodness of God in the past. And then we come to David's big asks. And he says this, "Answer me quickly, Lord. My spirit fails. Do not hide your face from me, or I will be like those who go down to the pit. Let the morning bring me word of your unfailing love, for I have put my trust in you. Show me the way I should go, for to you I entrust my life." David's from somewhere has decided that he can ask God for some pretty big things here. He's asking the God who created the world, the God who chose this nation and drew it out, to answer him individually. He's asking him to bring him a message of his unfailing love. And the psalm goes on. David doesn't stop there. He doesn't just ask for signs of God's presence. He asks for rescuing from his enemies. "I hide myself in you. Teach me to do your will, for you are my God. May your good spirit lead me on level ground." David is confident. He's asking for so much, isn't he? The psalm just goes on to ask for preservation of his life and in his unfailing love to silence his enemies. David is really confident. Where is David getting this faith from? Where is David getting this confidence from? How can he ask God for any of this with any degree of confidence? David is confident because he spent time meditating on God's actions in the past. He spent time considering them, and he's reached the conclusion that God is good and that he loves him. So that's all good for David. We spent some time in David's world. But what do we make of all this? How do we find faith in God? When we're right at the end of ourselves, when we're right at the bottom, how can we get any confidence that God is going to act? Now, the glorious truth of the good news of Jesus is, of course, that God takes the first action. He steps into our world. He opens our eyes to him. However much we might think, however much as we reflect on our journey into faith and we think, yeah, I sought out God, I searched him out, all of a sudden we discover, don't we, when we turn to God, oh no, it was him pursuing me the whole time. But David does take action in this psalm. But there's what does he do? On a regular basis for several years as a church, we've had weeks of prayer twice a year. Every month we have a prayer meeting, and since the lockdown, every day for 7 weeks, we've been gathering virtually to pray. Nearly every evening at 8 p.m. in the evening. If you want to join in, you're very welcome. The details are on the Grace Church Truro Facebook group. And on Thursdays we gather at 11 a.m. instead. But why do we bother? Why do we do this? How do we keep going? And how do we have faith in God? What happens when you're talking to someone and they're really clearly suffering and you want to pray for them? Is it just a last ditch effort to pray for them? Is it just like tossing a coin down a wishing well? Because sometimes, if we're honest, we can all feel a bit like that. Sometimes when we're faced with the emptiness in our own heart, when we come to pray for someone or pray for something, perhaps we just don't know what to ask God for. What do we do? Here's David's answer in this psalm. He says he meditates. He says he meditates. So isn't that a bit new agey? Is it a bit Buddhism-ish? Is this really Christianity? Well, no, not really. Actually, yes, the earliest records of meditation we know of are in India. You kind of have these images of people, statues and things of people meditating. But the first time meditation is mentioned in the Bible is right back near the start. It's actually in Isaac's life. In Genesis chapter 24. But even there, it's not even introduced as a big new thing. It's just mentioned as if it's something you kind of might want to do. And this dates meditation for us in the Judeo-Christian faith back to at least 1800 BC. So been around for a while. What is this meditation that David does? Now, I'm pretty sure that the three lines in this psalm all describe the same thing. He says it's a remembering, a meditation, and considering. David is deeply immersing himself in the remembering and considering of God's powerful works in the past. So, what's David doing? There's some things he's not doing. And these things have come to be associated with meditation, the word meditation, for a while. He's not clearing his mind of everything and trying to make himself entirely empty. He's not trying to put off the physical and focus only on the spiritual or anything like that. David isn't trying to immerse himself in his present surroundings. He's not trying to connect himself with nature. He's not practicing mindfulness and making himself aware of every part of his being and attempting to feel more himself. That isn't what David means by meditation here. Thirdly, David isn't trying to find something within himself and reach down into his own core of comfort and peace. He's not finding something inside himself. And this is really important. There are many practices of meditation that we'll find, and I wouldn't necessarily say that they're bad or unhelpful, but they're not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about Christian meditation. Christian meditation isn't about emptying ourselves, and it isn't about focusing into the centre to find the answers within. Christian meditation is all about this. It's focusing our whole beings on our amazing God, spending time caught up and wrapped up in him and in his revelation to us. See, David here spends time remembering God's acts in the past. What does this mean for us today? We can spend time remembering God's acts in the past, can't we? We can spend time really wrapping ourselves up in what God's shown himself to be like, what he's shown himself to do. Now, this is different from studying the Bible. I'd say the point of studying the Bible, the point of kind of trying to dive in and really pull it apart, not pull it apart, that's the wrong phrase, but all of that, is to get something out of it. We're explicitly trying to pull out principles, or we're really trying to learn something to put into practice. And that is a fantastic thing to do, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about simply exposing ourselves to its truth and letting that truth do its work in us. We're letting the record of God's goodness impact us without trying to draw out conclusions, without pulling out principles. It's an act of enjoyment and savouring God's goodness. You'll notice here that we do see the language in the Bible sometimes where somebody's praying to God and they're like, God, you were like this then, and so be like that now, or you said you would do this, so do this now. This is your character, this is what you're like. We do see that kind of language, but that isn't what we're seeing here. What we're seeing here is David immersing himself in the acts of God's acts in the past, and he's bathing himself in them. And out of that, deeply out of that, comes this call for help with faith. So how might we go about doing this? Because there's no specific practices listed in this psalm, and there's not really a lot of specific practices listed in the Bible around how meditation should work. Well, here's one thing that some people do. Some people will read part of the Bible, for example, an account of part of Jesus's life, and imagine themselves into it. You could do that. You can read a section of a gospel, or maybe one story, and really imagine yourself into it. To do that, read the passage several times over so that you've really got the flow of the account really clear, and then imagine yourself perhaps into the position of a disciple or one of the onlookers or the person being healed or wherever it might be. You might do it several times over, imagining yourself into different positions, but taking that time just to really immerse yourself in the glory of what Jesus has done at that time. In other places in the Psalms, we find meditation attached to singing. Singing can most definitely be meditative, as can listening to music. If you don't particularly enjoy singing, or you don't find that to be something that connects you to God, it might be, for example, if you're into classical music, you might listen to Handel's Messiah. That's a lengthy chunk of music, but that is a musically, it describes the story of Jesus's death and resurrection. And rather than listening for the beauty of the music, focus on allowing it to transport you into those days before and after Easter, and really considering the glory of what God, Jesus did for you on the cross in that case. Or here's another way of meditating. Memorization. You might read one of God's acts in the past, and you might memorize it. Now, the purpose of this isn't to achieve memorization. Again, it's not about trying to pull something out and trying to achieve something and make something better for the future. It's about immersing yourself in the story. But memorization can really help us to immerse ourselves in God's goodness and meditate on his goodness. I've got something here. If you're artistic, you might like this kind of thing. This is a story map, and kids use these a lot in school for sketching out different elements of the story. This is the crab who spoke, and you can see all the different bits along the way. It's one of my kids does that for school. But you might want to take a passage of the Bible and sort of just memorize it by sketching out the phases of that story, kind of comic book style, I suppose. But however you choose to do it, the key is to take it slow and include lots of repetition. The central element of meditation is to focus our whole selves on the glorious work that God has done. Now, in Psalm 143, where we've been, David's focusing his meditation on what God has done, and that's a really common subject that we find for meditation in the Psalms, but that isn't all that we can meditate on. That isn't our only fuel for prayer and for pouring ourselves out to God. There are two other key subjects that we find for meditation in the Psalms, and those are the law of God and God's promises. So first of all, the law of God. Now, as Christians, we aren't judged by the law in quite the same way that David was, but God's law isn't wiped out by Jesus. It's completed by him. So here's the key thing. The law of God is all about living God's way, choosing not to live by our own immediate human desires and wants, but trusting that our Father who created us knows better than we do what we want, what is good for us and how to live well. And God has established key principles for living, and Jesus summed these up in the two greatest commandments: to love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our mind, and with all our strength, and to love our neighbour as ourselves. A week and a half ago, I led the prayer meeting in a short meditation on these two commandments. I simply read them out slowly over and over, allowing the words to sink in and do two things. First of all, to allow God's Spirit to convict us of where we've gone wrong. And secondly, to allow God's Spirit to change us, to receive the grace of God, that we're not pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps, but God will change us by the power of his Spirit. And we can meditate on the law this God's good way of living in many ways. We could do what we did in that prayer meeting and simply speak the words over and over again. You can use singing. There are worship songs which incorporate the law of God. We can put words in front of us and simply read them over and over again in silence. Silence can be a great way to meditate, just as long as, remember, it's not about emptying ourselves to nothingness, it's about focusing ourselves on the good revelation of God. And thirdly, so we've talked about the past act of God, we talked about the law of God, and thirdly, the promises of God for the future. We find David meditating in other psalms on the promises of God. And this is a great thing to meditate on. Again, we can use all kinds of tools for this. Personally, I've used music to really help me with meditating on promises. There's a particular piece of music that stands out for me. It's called I Can Only Imagine by a group called Mercy Me, which speaks really beautifully of the individual experience of encountering Jesus when he returns. Whilst we're in lockdown, and I know that some people have loads of time and some people have very little, but whether it's 5 minutes or 5 hours, can I encourage us all to spend some time bathing in God's revealed, and let God's revealed goodness transform us? You might maybe feel a bit guilty about self-indulgence with it, but just let's keep to this central key element. It's about absorbing ourselves in God's goodness, not about us, and then letting God do the changing and transforming. Now, the idea of meditation, I think, can be really, it can be intimidating sometimes. I hope that by explaining some mechanisms that we can use, I've kind of helped a bit today. But here's the key thing. It's not about achieving. And there's this short book on meditation I've been reading recently that I think might be helpful, because many of us get distracted a lot of the time when we want to spend time with God, and we want to be refreshed by his presence, and we get distracted. And this is by Madeleine Simon, and it's written principally to parents. If you find your mind wandering all the time, I think you'll find this encouraging. Now, what about those seemingly endless distractions? Does it mean that you're not suited to this kind of prayer? Nothing of the sort. They're just another form of weakness, like the thorn in the side that Paul talked about. If you follow this advice once more, you'll take a positive view of them as you gently turn back to your meditation and through it to the life and prayer of Christ within. 52 distractions can mean 52 deliberate turnings back to God in the silence of your heart. And what more selfless prayer can there be than this? A distractionless period of meditation might be really comforting for you, but it wouldn't necessarily be a better meditation. The only valid assessment of meditation is a change in the quality of one's life, or I would add our relationship with God, over a period of time. And this is often noticed by those around us rather than by ourselves. It'll certainly be noticed by the children in our care. I'd love for us as a church over this time to really be immersing ourselves in God's goodness, because I can't point you to me to save you, because I'm not going to save you. I can't point you to anyone else in the church who's going to save you, but we can point one another towards Jesus. And as we do that, and as we focus our whole beings on him, whether it's just for short periods of time, I think we're going to know a closeness with God and a power to live that's unlike anything we've known before. Let's finish by meditating, shall we? If you've got a house full, you might find it a bit more helpful to come back a bit later and replay this part of a message when you've got a bit more space. I'm going to read the start of Revelation chapter 21. It's a revelation of what's going to happen when Jesus returns. If you're new to the Christian faith, we believe that one day Jesus is going to return in power, and he's going to change this world. He's going to make it new. And this is a promise for the future from God, for what that world is going to be like. To prepare, can I ask you to take a moment to ensure that you're comfortable? Make sure you're sitting, if you can be, sitting reasonably upright, feet on the floor, arms rested on the arms of your chair or hands folded in your lap. Close your eyes and listen to this. It's the promise of God for what is coming. I'm going to reread a few sections to allow them to sink in. And just so that you're aware, it does contain symbolic language. When it says there is no sea, it's not because God's against surfing or sailing or any kind of water sports, really. It's that the sea, to the speaker of this, is really symbolic of the source of unknown, unpredictable threats. And so when it says there is no sea, it's an indication of safety and security. Okay, so we're going to start now. Do close your eyes and listen to this. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death. There will be no more death. There will be no more death. Or mourning. Or crying. Or pain. For the old order of things has passed away." He who was seated on the throne said, "I am making everything new." Then he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." These words are trustworthy and true. He said to me, "It is done. It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. To the thirsty I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all of this. And I will be my God, and they will be my children. I will be their God, and they will be my children. God bless you. So we can't save ourselves, we can't do anything to make ourselves more acceptable to God, but let's take time, shall we, to immerse ourselves in the goodness of what God's done for us. How he leads us in the present moment and what he promises for the future. Let's encourage one another day by day to immerse ourselves in God's goodness. If you would like to know more about following Jesus, if you'd like to know more about the goodness that he has for you, then please do get in touch at info@gracetruro.org. We'd love to, as I said at the start, we'd love to connect you with the church community and help you find out more about Grace Church, but most importantly, more about our glorious God.